Hi, I'm India Fisher, and this is The Sirens of Audio.
It's all very well to make these demands, but Doctor Who fans already have a plethora of podcasts to choose from.
I created the show you host on your platforms. I have a right to the subscription.
I'm well aware of that, great podcaster. I would willingly get this fan to write 1,000 reviews if Apple Podcasts allowed it.
And I would write them willingly.
You see how devoted we are. But you'd get very little for him writing a review or subscribing. And I would be without a good anorak. Good anoraks are very hard to find.
I do not wish to hear any more from your prattling tongue! Forgive me, I need more subscribers. I cannot reach more audience without them.
We'll do our best for you. I'm sure Anorak can engage in a little creative bot activity on your behalf.
I already do, madam. I'm a past master at the double entry.
Then you must make it triple. You heard what Audiophile said. He needs the subscribers.
Do not call me by my name on an open channel!
I'm so sorry, great podcaster. Such is my enthusiasm for your cause. My tongue sometimes speaks what my mind would not dare to think. Please accept my apologies.
I would sooner accept your subscription.
Ha 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 ha. Ha 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 ha.
G'day, Audiophiles. This is The Sirens of Audio, the show that explores the universe of Doctor Who in the audio medium. I'm Dwayne.
And I'm Philip. G'day, Dwayne. G'day, Audiophiles.
G'day, Philip. It's good to see you. It's been seems to have been a while since we've seen each other.
It does.
But, it's good to see you again. How's things?
Yeah, things are great. Finally had to go back to work. That was a bit depressing. And I actually had 5 days in a row at work this week. But I want another one of those for another 3 or 4
Outrageous.
Weeks. Oh, I know. It's been shocking. So, I mean, even when I went back to work 2 weeks ago, I still had days off, you know, public holidays, other things. And I had to do a whole week. It was just not fair. But the next 3 or 4 weeks aren't 4 weeks again. So that's good.
And in my universe, I'm still over in Western Australia. I'm in the just south of Perth, and I've been doing a lot of exploring of Perth. I'll be in the Perth area for another week. So if anyone's listening from Perth, let me know. It's nice to know where our listeners are from. So I will be here for another week, and I'll be heading north up into the hot weather. It's 42 degrees in Perth, but I'm going north just because I thought, well,
gosh,
it's not hot enough. Need a bit more. Today's going to be a great episode. We're going to be talking with another Big Finish writer who we haven't had on the show before. Well, we did. We took a clip from this and put it in an episode a couple of months back. But Eddie Robson will be joining us, so that's going to be fantastic. But before we get to that, there's a couple of things to do. First thing up, you're very, very busy this week preparing for our forthcoming events. Tell us more.
Well, as we speak at the moment, but probably after this has come out, Wendy Padbury flies into Sydney tomorrow morning. So I'm off to the airport to get her. It's really ridiculous time in the morning. But yeah, I'll be picking her up, and also her daughter and Big Finish actress Charlie Hayes. And we'll do some stuff tomorrow in the city. We'll go to the northern beaches and do some fish and chips. And yeah, so it's supposed to be a glorious day in Sydney, so we're going to enjoy some ocean time. And no doubt she'll want to go home and get some sleep, because it's been a bit of a long overnight trip she's doing at the moment from Singapore. But it's going to be a great week, and really just building up to next Saturday. And yeah, so in Parramatta for Sydney people, next Saturday will be Wendy Padbury, and then the following Saturday for the VIP dinner, and Sunday for the event in Melbourne. So some big things happening.
Exciting. Still get tickets for those events if you head over to sirensofaudio.com. The links are on the main page.
Yeah, we're looking forward to hopefully getting a great crowd out to welcome Wendy and really make her visit worthwhile. And she's really looking forward to meeting the fans. So if you haven't got any tickets yet, it'd be really great to get them and come along. And Wendy is just a lovely, lovely woman, and you are going to have the best time with her.
Excellent. All right, one more thing to do, Philip, before we get to our chat with Eddie Robson. Do you know what that is?
I think it might have something to do with a big hole.
It is. Not that big, though. It's only a rabbit hole. Let's jump in. Right, we are here. And I'm glad, Philip, that you are sitting in your office with your figures behind you, because last time we had Kenny Smith joining us for our Best of Big Finish episode. And I know you and Kenny are very, very into your figures. So it's slightly off topic from audio, this rabbit hole. I want to ask you, it's a part of Doctor Who that I've never really been that interested in, and probably a good thing too, because I've probably got a little bit more money as a result. But I'd like to know, what is the appeal of all your figures? They look fantastic behind you, I must say. But I want you to try and talk me into it. What's the appeal for collecting figures?
Collecting figures. Well, I think collecting all things. I think males have a brain that want to collect. And so I think it always starts very young. And I probably started, I mean, in terms of collecting Doctor Who things, was probably my target books was the first thing I started collecting. In terms of the figures, I think they are just so amazing. As I said, you can see the ones behind me, but I have, you know, in front of me, I got, you know, so many more. You know, mine is all Rock Robot. For me, it's about nostalgia. It just brings back memories. And these are just, they're just so well made. You know, Magnus Greel. I mean, the costuming, the way they've done the robes, the detail is just astounding. And so for me, it's a memory of shows and how much I love them. And yeah, each figure brings back memories and brings back joy. And I guess part of it, in terms of collecting, it's just completism. And so once you've sort of got one or two, you sort of think, oh, well, I want to finish the set off. And so it starts off being quite cheap. But then because you want to try and finish things off. Now, a lot of them I got when they first came out. So when Doctor Who came back, and I was teaching back then, and the figures, I just bought them as they came out, and they were actually quite cheap. A lot of the stuff I got originally, and since they've been coming out now, I'm waiting on Monday, my Fugitive Doctor and TARDIS arrive. I could have had that here, but that hasn't quite arrived yet. But they all tell a story, and they, part of it is just memories. As I said, yeah, when you think about, yeah, got Omega there, Omega, what do you call him, and the Gel Guard, each one just brings back different memories, and they're just beautifully made, crafted. I wish there was more coming out than they are, but yeah, as I said, it's just about completism. And yeah, at the moment, as I said, you know, you can see all my doctors all in order, so I sort of got them in chronological order. But yeah, I'm getting ready now. Once my son gets married in 2 months' time, and I get the whole office to myself, I've already got plans for some more bookshelves. I'm going to start arranging, you know, and I'll set up stories. So yeah, you know, because I have the entire I've got the whole Pyramids of Mars set with, you know, Sutek and Lawrence Garman and mummies, but I've also got the spaceship that goes with that, and so yeah, I'll set up a display with the spaceship. And I'll set up all the figures to go with that. And I'll just change things over bit by bit. As you see, I've got, you know, all the Daleks. Actually, I haven't got all the Daleks on there. I've got some on the shelf over there because they don't all fit behind me. Even though I've created four layers of Daleks, there's still more that I have. But I'll probably set up a display of all the First Doctor with, companions. We've only got Ian out so far. But, you know, whatever creatures he's faced, TARDISes, things, and I'll just set up different displays and have different shelves, and, you know, you'll probably see them in future time if I set up the bookshelves behind me. But yeah, as I say, you know, I mean, I've got the Target prints as well up there. I have just, it's ridiculous how much stuff I have, and we just don't mention it to my wife. But keep telling the kids, make sure that when I'm gone, they sell it, and they have to sell them individually. Don't sell them as a drop lot, because these are all worth a lot of money now.
So here's a question for you. Do you recall, or do you have it to hand, the first figure that you purchased? that started you all off in this obsession?
I would think the first, I would have got a set of figures together. It would have been probably the classic range that it first came out, which would have been, 2006 or 2007, which was the, I got some of them. So it was the two Vok robots. It was Magnus Greel and Mr. Sin. It would have, it's one of the Tom Baker figures, the smiling Tom Baker figure from Robot. There was a Zygon included in that. There was a third Doctor character too. I'm trying to think of the third Doctor character. It wasn't Sea Devil. Can't remember. But I think there would have been eight. And together, when you put them all together, it came in bits. Can I find, hang on, if I can reach under here, that's going to be very attractive. And all the bits went together. In each was a bit, but together combined to make the giant robot.
Oh, wow. That's
and
cool.
So you know, there's a leg in one, another leg, arm, body, head, etc. And so the eight pack formed the giant robot. So that was probably the first. So I started with classic, even though there would have been, this would have started with, I'm telling you, with Ninth Doctor, Tenth Doctor. Probably Ninth Doctor was first and Rose. But I didn't quite get them first. I actually got the classics first. The classic is still, of course, my preference, even for the figures. Though I do have a whole display. Can I move the camera? Here we go. So yes, that's all the new series figures that were sitting in there. He's flying. You got one flying. So there they go. And then, as I said, they're my third Doctor figures are there. So there's a lot more up there, but it would have been that first classic set. And I think actually, talk about Kenny, the Power of Three podcast actually reviewed that set with Aldua. Dua. Sorry, Al. They had Al on the program, and he was actually talking about that first classic range. And it was actually quite interesting to listen to, because that was the first set I would have listened to, and that was the first set I would have got. I forget what else was in it, but that's roughly what was in that first set.
Cool. Very good. So if you get them at the time of the release, it's cheaper. You try and catch up with the collection and make it complete. These days, it would be getting quite expensive. Is that right?
That's right. Well, can I say, firstly, it's not cheap in Australia because we've got to pay postage. And so I know, so the latest stuff has just come out. So, you know, there's the Deadly Assassin Time Lords. There's, you know, three of those that just came out and a Tom Baker one. I think in England that was selling for £12.99, but out here it was $80, including postage. And so in Australia, we're already paying a lot more. And it's interesting, people in, yeah, those of you in the UK complaining. I know it's hard to find sometimes, but once you include postage, things can be really, really expensive. So good stuff.
But it looks for you like there's no turning back now.
Well, I basically have everything now. There would be some variants of some of the Doctors I'm missing, but not very many variants. I mean, I adore my Colin Baker in blue from the Big Finish real time story, and there's a different one of him in blue which comes in the 13th box set. I never got the 13 Doctors box set. Which is a bit of a shame, but that being said, there's another one of blue in here that I'd love to have. There's a Patrick Troughton, an old Patrick Troughton from the Two Doctors, Colin Baker. So I've already got one of the Patrick Troughtons with him as an Andragum, but they did a variant with him as being an old one from there. What else am I missing? There's not a lot that I haven't really got. So yeah, I've been pretty fortunate to pick up. I mean, I've got all the masters. There's another Missy in a slightly different color, purple, but I'm wearing a hat, which I'm missing. But I probably won't. Yeah, if it comes across as cheaply, I'll buy it. But yeah, I've got two Missies. I've got all the other masters, so I'm pretty happy with that. I'm missing the Revenge of the Cybermen. So there's a three pack. I think there's a three or four pack of Revenge of the Cybermen come out, and I missed that totally. So I got all the Cybermen except for the Revenge of the Cybermen ones, and it's particularly I love the what's he called? Supreme Leader? That's wrong. Whatever the one with the black helmet. I'd love to have him, but I haven't got him. But I do have invasion ones, which are, you know, fairly similar. But I mean, all the Daleks I have. I was hanging out for the Imperial, the War Dalek. But I got him a few months ago. So it's all coming together bit by bit. And that's just a question.
Just make sure if anything happens to you. I was telling my wife this about some stuff of mine too. That anything ever happens to me, make sure you know what things are worth. Don't sell these in a garage sale or something. Yeah. Make sure you know what they're worth.
Yeah. So, well, I have them all separately insured as a collection.
Gotcha.
Because, yeah, there's, I don't know, $15,000 worth of figures probably if you sold them the right way. It's ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, I haven't paid that for them, but in terms of what their value is now, it's like my hardbacks. You know, there's, you know, $10,000-$12,000 worth of hardbacks I have too, which I'm getting ready to sell because I decided to sell them. But I just haven't done it yet.
Okay. Didn't you only just get them?
Yes, I started getting them during COVID. And then I sort of thought, I'm basically looking and thinking to finish off. I mean, I probably have more than 3/4 of it now, but the ones I don't have are selling $6,000-$7,000 each. And I'm just, I'm not prepared to pay $1,000 for a hardback. I need to have some self-control. So as I can't complete the collection, I'm thinking I'll just sell it. Though,
gotcha.
Yeah. So if you want a hardback collection, but I'll be selling them one at a piece too. I'm not going to sell the whole thing together because it's going to be worth more splitting it up and selling bit by bit.
Yeah. Well, is it an interesting what us fans do in terms of our fandom, whether it be collecting things or listening to things, as you and I both do? Very fascinating stuff.
Just talk about that. I mean, it was hard work moving from the physical Big Finish CDs because, you know, originally and upstairs I have, you know, 5, 6, 8 years of CDs from Big Finish. Yeah, and actually moving from Big Finish into streaming was actually hard work to do. But once again, it was really the postage that did it. It was just getting to the point where I just, when the postage is more than the product. I mean, I so desperately want the Big Finish cover book, but the postage was, I think it's 1.5 times more than the actual book is to get it posted out to me. I can't justify spending $200 on postage. But once again, so that's something I'd love to have. I don't know
how anyone can justify charging that for postage.
Hoping it might come onto Amazon, and Amazon have free postage, as much as Amazon's an evil company. shame. But... you know, when you're a Prime member, you actually get free postage, and that actually does make some things more feasible.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Good to talk to you about something a little different for a change. We're going to climb up out of the rabbit hole and bring on Eddie Robson in a moment. But I thought first, before we bring him on, I'll throw on a trailer for his Big Finish audio. Was it Memory Lane, the Eighth Doctor adventure?
It probably was. I'd have to double check that now. That's pushing my memory too hard.
I hope it was. So I know Eddie Robson's an Eighth Doctor. He specializes in Eighth Doctor stories. And this is, if not his first, one of his early ones. So I'll be back with Eddie Robson in a moment.
Excuse me, I was here first.
I'm sorry, you go.
Can I get a Mr. Whippy?
With a flake?
Yeah, of course. Who has a Whippy without a flake?
Chocophobics?
Imagine that, being afraid of chocolate. That'd be terrible.
Dreary street.
Why'd you say that?
All the houses look the same.
Welcome to suburbia.
No, I mean they really do look identical. Gardens, curtains, look. Hello?
Is there a tall blue box in your house?
Not that I know of, dear.
Fine, never mind.
Don't move.
Why not?
Because I'm pointing a gun at you.
Is that a gun?
Yes, it is.
Yes?
Hello. Have you seen me before?
I don't think so, dear.
And there isn't a police box in your front room?
No.
Thank you. You've been terribly helpful.
What is the most ruthless thing in the bakery?
What's a bakery?
A teller the bun.
It's kind of funnier if you knew him.
Charlie, look. These are my astronauts. The red one's me, the blue one is Samuel, and the yellow one is Kim.
Oh, is Kim a boy or a girl?
I don't know.
Well, you must have heard the name somewhere before.
Just made it up.
Blue box.
Pardon, dear?
Blue box. Tall one.
I'm afraid I'm not sure what you mean.
No good, then. Forget it.
Describe it to me again.
A sort of tall blue box.
Remind me, Lest, why do you feel it's significant?
I don't think it's ever been there before.
This is a warning for anyone who can pick it up. I can't do anything about this. I'm sorry, but I'm about to crash into what looks like a populated area. If anyone gets killed, I'm really, really sorry.
I know you.
Do you?
Yes, I've seen you on telly.
So, today we have prolific Big Finish writer Eddie Robson. He's written many short stories, audio stories. He's written far broader than just Big Finish as well. And so, Eddie, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for asking me on.
Let's start from the beginning. Where did you grow up? And tell us about your interest in writing.
Yeah, well, I was born in York. And when I was 7 years old, moved down to a village in Buckinghamshire called Wendover. And I think, the early things I remember about wanting to write, I remember writing my own. I was very into Transformers, and I bought Transformers comic, and I remember creating my own Transformers comic. But it taught me something about writing, actually, because it sort of always used to frustrate me, like, you know, as a kind of tiny child who didn't really understand how stories worked, like, you know, why can't they ever win? Why can't the goodies ever win in this? And then I wrote one where they did win. And then it's something that's kind of over now, isn't it? So I guess there won't be any more stories. So yeah, maybe that's why they don't just have the good guys win when they've got these sort of endless, endless machine to feed for stories. But it was really, when I started secondary school, I remember doing a story about, we'd been set a thing to do a story about World War One. You were always getting told to write things about World War One at school back then. I did something that was sort of, I don't know, I think the extent of my research was watching Blackadder go for. But I wrote it, and my English teacher, got me to read it out. And said, oh, when Edward's a famous writer, you can all say you knew him, which, like, obviously, like, pissed off everyone else in the class and didn't make me popular at all. But it did kind of put the seed in my head of, like, I could be a writer. Like, but I hadn't really thought of it until then, but maybe. And actually, from then on, I never seriously wanted to do anything else. I sort of had the odd whims about doing things, but really, it's always been writing.
So when you went to university, is that what you studied, or how did your writing career progress?
I didn't do any, because at university I studied English literature. I looked into, there were far fewer creative writing undergraduate degrees around that. I did apply to what the one in Norwich, which I think was the only one in the country at the time, which was Split English Creative Writing. And now there are lots. So, and in the end, I didn't want to go to that university. I decided I wanted to go to Sheffield University, which is where I went. But actually, what really changed there was I'd done a lot of bits of writing as a teenager, but I don't think I ever finished anything. I don't think I ever even like finished a short story. I think I must have pitched... I know I got the New Adventures Guidelines. I sent off for the New Adventures Guidelines. This is it. Like, the fact that the New Adventures existed and... you'd hear about this stuff, and you knew that, like, people in fandom were going from writing fanfic to writing for the New Adventures was a big thing of, like, making it feel attainable, even though I never got a Doctor Who novel commissioned, even when they went to BBC Books and I pitched them all. I never managed to do that. But it was a big thing for me of realizing, oh, it's attainable. You can send a manuscript to a publisher and, you know, this happens. So I definitely had the guidelines. I don't know whether I'd ever actually sent them one. I did start working on ideas for New Adventures. But university was, yeah, I actually started to write more and got close. I still don't think I ever really finished anything, but I got closer to getting things finished. And I did, I got involved with like fan things. So there was like, there was at least one, possibly two, Bernie Summerfield. What did you call them? I can't think of the word, but it was when it was like sort of a consequences type thing. You know, you'd do a round robin fiction, and one person would write a chapter, and then you'd hand it on to the next person and say, "Okay, well, you write the next chapter. You write the next chapter." You see where they went. That was quite that was quite a good thing to do in terms of just yeah, just committing to doing something and actually doing it because somebody else was relying on you to write your bit so they could write their bit. And I started doing more and more when I was there, and I got more involved in fandom and doing did oh yeah, of course I did short stories for did I started a Bernie Sumfield fanzine, which I wrote some short stories for. So they were probably the first things I actually finished and put out there.
Well, can we go back to, let's go back to, because you're going into fandom, let's go back to Doctor Who. So when did you first get interested in Doctor Who? How did that happen?
I was a little bit late to Doctor Who because we weren't a Doctor Who household. My parents don't really do science fiction at all. In fact, my mum told me that she'd tried to read my last novel and had got about she'd got like a couple of chapters in and was like, "Oh no, I'm quite into this." And then she just got to like chapter three, she was like, "Oh no, I just can't." So I remember I have a clear memory of watching the cliffhanger of second part of Terror of the Vervoids and being scared of it, and then tuning in next week to watch it again and being scared again and turning off the episode immediately because I was too scared. But suddenly, yeah, when I remember it was I was 9, in the middle of Delta and the Bannermen, I started watching that and I suddenly was had enough fortitude to not be scared of it, and got into it, and it was about, yeah, I think it was between, yeah, between seasons 25 and 26. I started buying Doctor Who magazine, and I started seeking out the novelizations in libraries and things. And that was, yeah, that was it really. It became my thing. I remember I just dropped Transformers comic that summer, and was sort of looking for something else to read, and that was like, oh, Doctor Who, I like Doctor Who. And that was the first issue I bought, issue 150, is completely falling apart because I read it cover to cover over and over again. There's so many fascinating things in it. There was like a feature about two of the Cybermen and something about missing episodes, and yeah, it was sort of just it really did feel like, oh gosh, there's a whole big world here. And I was just at the right age, I guess, to really want something where you could really dig into it. That's kind of the upside of coming in at the end when it was just finishing was that there was a lot to discover and you could kind of do it as you wanted. Like I've always something kind of weirdly appropriate about the fact that I've experienced Doctor Who completely out of sequence, because it was whatever was on VHS that month or whatever I could get hold of, whatever a friend had a copy of that they would lend me. So I'd kind of pieced it all together very gradually over a decade or so.
You say you started a Bernie Summerfield magazine.
In 1998, I think around when the I think we'd already started to do it before the big Finnish ones started, but I think it coincided nicely, and they were like they asked us like, you know, do you want to come down to the studio and do a report and write about and things. So yeah, no, it was just me and some friends. It was partly through love of the character and partly through, I don't know, seeing a gap in what else was out there. We just kind of said, oh, no one's doing one, let's do one. We called it Oh No It Is. Did we call it Oh No It Isn't, or did we call it Oh Yes It Is? Yeah, we called it Oh Yes It Is.
Right. So what about so do you have any professional writing stuff happen before Big Finish in terms of new
No, my first
publishers?
stuff. So yeah, the first thing I ever had out professionally was a short story in their first short story collection, The Dead Men Diaries, which I think I've never gone back and looked at again. I don't think it's very good, but I always appreciated Paul Cornell because I'd written the short stories for the fanzine, which are also not very good. And you know, don't go looking for them, please.
I've got it on my bookshelf.
Oh, you do? Oh, good grief! Right, yeah. But yeah, that was a big deal for me at the time. It's an odd mix of people because Stephen Moffat's got a story in that, which is great. It's another one of his sort of, I think it's an early take effectively on The Girl in the Fireplace, that thing of a character meeting somebody else in a kind of different periods in their life, and you know, years pass for one person and like 2 minutes passes for another person. So that's good. That's worth reading, but mine isn't. But yeah, that was the first time I was paid for writing fiction. And in fact, the first time I was paid for writing anything was Doctor Who magazine in 1999.
Oh, what did you write for them?
They did a feature about, they were doing like, it was the anniversary issue of TWUM, not the anniversary issue of Doctor Who. So it was 20 years of TWUM, and they went like, that Gary Gillett wanted 20 like moments from each of the last 20 years. And I said I'd been to Glastonbury that year, and someone had actually set up a tent just showing tapes of Doctor Who on a TV set. Just somewhere you could just go and chill out and watch Planet of the Spiders. And so I said, I'd write something about that if you want. He said, yeah, great. So that was, yeah, my first bit of professional writing.
So how did your Big Finish career develop and grow?
First of all, I did sound them out about doing audios, and I always got a sort of like, oh, maybe response from Gary Russell. But I did manage to get a few short stories done, which was partly because I pitched a short story to Jack Rayner at the BBC, which she'd hoped to include in an anthology and hadn't been able to. And then when Big Finish started doing the anthologies, she came back to me and said, I would like you to do that, but the theme is different. Can you work in a different theme? So I think it was originally pitched for one that was going to be about like odd Doctor companion teams and things. And I'd actually said, oh, can I crowbar in? It felt bold at the time, crowbarring in a Sarah Kingdom story, which of course, and we've done plenty of Sarah Kingdom stories now. And then Jack said, I've got one called Short Trips Zodiac. I think that was the one. Said, can you find like a way to make it work for a Zodiac thing? So I said, okay, it's got a kid in it. So if it's Gemini, maybe we could make them twins and make twins part of the story. She said, yeah, great. So I rewrote it for that. And then she came back and said, there isn't space in that one for you. We've already got a Gemini, but we've got another one coming up. And if you can kind of fit it into that, then I was like, okay. So it ended up having another theme of some kind put onto it. I can't remember what the sequence was. Maybe that was the companions one. I don't know. Anyway, it had three different umbrella themes imposed onto it to try and make it fit the theme of a collection. And eventually it came out. And then, yeah, they got me to do a few more short stories. But what really changed things was that, so they'd had an issue where, there a few things where scripts had fallen through at a late stage when they had the studio books. And that would always put them in a bit of a hole because it's like, well, we've committed to paying the actors, we've committed to hiring the studio. What we really could do with is for each of the main ranges that they had at that time, each of their four doctors that they were working on, we'd like to have a backup script that if one falls through, we can just push that one in and then we go, then, you know, we've always... And yes, yeah, so having one for each doctor so that whoever they'd hired at that time, they could just go, okay, no, we've got one for Colin, so we'll put that one in its place. And so I got asked, I remember this was during the Eccleston season being on, I think it was like after Aliens of London had just been on. I clearly remember that. Suddenly Gary Russell said, would you like to write one? It probably won't come out until the summer of 2007, because like they said, you know, if it doesn't get used as a backup for that block, we'll push it into the next block and we'll commission another backup for the next one. So it wouldn't just be endlessly sitting there waiting for its turn. But, you know, could you do it? So I wrote Memory Lane. Gary said, thank you very much. We'll keep this on file and, you know, let you know. And then suddenly, at the end of that year, Gary said, we are going to record it next week. So something else had fallen through. And we went in, and also Gary had an idea that he felt that because it was quite pacey, and I'd kept it quite short, and tried not to overwrite, he reckoned that they could get it done in a day. And they did, actually. That was kind of mad. Looking back, that was kind of mad that they did that. Basically, I think on top of that, they had also done some extra scenes with, because Annika Wills wasn't available on the Friday when we were recording it. So they'd done her scenes already. And Gary reckoned, I think if we've already got those in the can, then we'll only have about 80 minutes of material to record, and I think we can do it all in a day. And they did. And that was quite, it gave it a good energy, actually. But that was, that worked out well for me, because literally a few months after that, and Paul McGann had liked doing the story, and he'd said to Gary, get him back in again next time we do a run, because I, you know, that was a good script. And then suddenly the opportunity to do the McGann series for BBC Seven came up. And because of having done Memory Lane, and because of that having gone well, I got invited to do stuff for that. And I think if my script had just kind of been still waiting for its turn when that had come up, I don't think I would have got invited to pitch for it. So it was kind of, it just, everything suddenly, after waiting years to kind of get my in with Big Finish, suddenly I did, and everything fell into place because I did that, and then that went well, and suddenly I had a period where they were just asking me all the time, like, oh, we've got something that needs doing here. Can you want to do that? Like, well, we need, you know, when Nick Briggs took over, he said, I really want to kick off with a couple of new things to set a new tone for it. So can you write something quickly for us to that we can kind of push into the schedule in early 2007? And yeah, I had a good few years when it was just constantly, can you do this, can you do that? Can you do a story for the David Warner Doctor? You know, all this sort of thing.
So how did you go from writing prose to audio? Was that difficult?
Not really, actually. No, it's not. I'd always wanted to do script writing. And I had tried doing some radio stuff. So, because I knew that was where there were a lot of opportunities that if you wanted to write for the BBC, then it was a good place to start. So, yeah, I'd written a fair few things like that. And, it's just about, like, finding your technique for, for how you make things clear to the reader and how you clear for the listener, and how you how you keep the pace going, how you break things up. I mean, one thing that I always think is quite significant in audio is that which you don't have to worry about so much with visual media is that it's usually pretty obvious on film or TV when you've moved to a different location, you're doing something different. Actually, with audio, it's always quite good to kind of have something where you get a clear break and you really feel like you're somewhere different, and so the audience is like, oh, right, okay, right, now we're doing this, and you know, and communicate that sort of thing. So there's a few things like that I really need to pick up, but everyone was very helpful with that kind of thing, you know, because they're all very experienced at Big Finish and most of those things.
I do think Memory Lane had a lot of really powerful images in terms of just the house after house after house being identical, and the fear is a bit like the Screwtape Letters in some ways by C.S. Lewis. This unending streets that never end. It's a for a first script, it was a really big success one. As you say, you then go on to be a bit of an Eighth Doctor aficionado, and once again, Human Resources is a very powerful, important script, double parter. Where was the change between Gary and Nick?
It would have been sometime in 2006. I know that I think Nick had already been given responsibility for doing the BBC Seven series. And then after that, Gary stepped aside and he took over the main range. But essentially what you say about the imagery is I actually remember what I was thinking when I was doing that. I was thinking, what is good imagery that would be difficult to actually realise? Even if you had a big effects budget, what would be difficult to actually realise? I'd actually just been listening to, I'd been heavily listening to the Mighty Boosh's radio series. And there's a lot of stuff in that where, like, they would just sort of conjure something with words and you'd think, oh, that's a good image, but actually it'd be really hard to show that. Even if you had a great budget, it's sort of one that you want to kind of provoking in the listener's mind a bit more. And I think a lot of that, yeah, the infinite stream was definitely one of those. That was a huge thing. I'm thinking, yeah, no, that's something where, you know, however an infinite stream seems in your imagination, that's what it's like.
Yeah. I mean some of the different stories I'd love to talk about. I guess one that stood out to me along the way was Situation Vacant, where it's Paul McGann, well, the Eighth Doctor, interviewing different companions, a whole series of mishaps and interesting things that happen. That's probably one of the funniest scripts that you've done up to that point. Was there a particular desire you had to start being able to do a bit of comedy?
Maybe. I think, though, in that case, it was just I'd been handed, that was one where I'd been handed the concept. I did two for that run, and one, there was Situation Vacant and Prisoner of the Sun. And yeah, Situation Vacant, Prisoner of the Sun was my own, was just something I came to them with. But Situation Vacant was Alan Barnes said, what I want to do, I want to introduce a new companion and make it like The Apprentice, but with the Doctor as Alan Sugar. Go away and make that work. And I think we all knew that just was obviously going to be a comedy one. It just didn't seem one to try and play that completely straight, because there was a contrivance about it, and I felt like running with that was better than kind of trying to make it feel like something that would naturally happen. And you know, it's people on The Apprentice just are ludicrous anyway. You are effectively doing a parody, and it felt like an opportunity to send up a certain type of person, or several certain types of person in the end.
Coming soon from Big Finish Productions.
Good morning, I'm the Doctor.
My name's Asha Qureshi.
I'm Theo Lawson.
My name's Juliette Walsh.
Hugh Bainbridge.
I relied on my companions for help. Theo, grab the end of the cable, then come back.
I'm on it.
Advice?
We need to take bold, smart, effective action.
I relied on their skills.
Doctor, look, it's got a USB port.
Knowledge.
You know, it's not just scientists who've disappeared.
And sense of morality.
Not so fast!
You need to be self-motivated.
What do you think you're doing?
Saving your life!
Bravery.
Oh, crikey, it's coming this way!
But also capable of working harmoniously with me and anybody else who might join us in my TARDIS.
Please follow me into the blue box!
Any questions?
Doctor Who, Situation Vacant. Subscribers get more at bigfinish.com.
One of my loves in Big Finish is the Companion Chronicles, because they're able to be really creative. And one of my favorites is the Jigsaw War, featuring Fraser Hines, which is a story, for people who don't know, it's a story that is told in all the wrong order. And part of the companion's job is to try and work out what's the correct order to actually solve the problem. I'm just curious, in terms of when you wrote that, did you actually write that chronologically and then cut it up, or did you actually do it in the pieces? How did you actually come to do something like that?
I can't remember. No, I don't think I did. I don't think I did do it chronologically and then cut up. I think I just wrote it as it was. Did I try reading it? I think I might have tried reading it in that sequence, in the chronological sequence. Because one of the ideas I'd had would be that if you wanted to, if you had it on CD or like, you know, or as a playlist, you could reorder the tracks and listen to it in the order. But I think it's one of those things where it sounds like a cute idea, but I'm not sure whether it actually would work as a listening experience doing it in that order. But of course, I think the thing is that ultimately Jamie is experiencing it in that order, so. The important thing is how it appears to him emotionally.
One of the important sequences of stuff that you had was the Bernice Summerfield. Obviously, you've always had a passion for Bernice, and you go on to write many Bernice audios, but you also had a big role to play in terms of shaping that series. How did that come about?
Simon Guerrier was moving on as producer, and he said, did I want to take over? I think it was an odd one, that, because Simon had, by that time, the Bernice series had acquired quite a lot of quite a big regular cast, but the budget on that was such that you had to really try and do it with a cast of four. In fact, I think we had four and a half. You could kind of you could have five in one play and then four in the next one. And maybe if you were very clever with things, you could maybe get a bit of something on one session and put it on another play. But yeah. And so Simon said the biggest issue that he had, and the thing that was taking up a lot of his time, was just the logistics of trying to get everyone free at the same time. And he felt that the best thing to do would be to wrap up the whole collection thing and come up with a simpler format and liberate his successor to just sort of like take it where they want it. And that was, and I was like, okay, I appreciate that. That's great. And so his final one, which I co-produced so that we could kind of steer it together, was, yeah, ended with the collection having a whole load of stuff happening and Bernice escaping. But what I almost immediately found was people started saying, like, oh, when are you going to go back to the collection and deal with all that stuff that was going on there? And I was like, really going to? I as far as I was concerned, it had been wrapped up. But it kind of hadn't. We had kind of left it open with the waiver to go back. I think just because I wanted to have the sense of her being on the run and having to keep moving to give a bit of urgency to it, rather than it just being, oh, well, I've had enough time here and I'm going to go and move on somewhere else. But it did mean that, yeah, people were like, you know, and yeah, but we'd spent years with all these characters that people had built up an affection for. And there was a kind of sense of like, well, we could do to, you know, actually go back and finish their story. So what we ended up doing was I'd done one series where I hadn't really dealt with it on, that was very sort of quite standalone-y. Not entirely, but a bit. And it also, and I built in something where
was it the Epoch series or?
There was one where we had it kicked off with one play, and then we had two in the middle where because Lisa Bauman was quite interested in directing one and only being minimally in it. And so we decided that we were going to do two in the middle where, like, they've been separated, and one is about Bernice and one is about Thomas, her son, and then we bring them back together later. Right. So that was really, and you know, we only had four plays, so once we'd kind of done that and then done a finale, we were like, okay, that's that done. But then people started to kind of say, we want to see the characters again. So in the next series, we started to bring them back, the other characters back, and started leading in towards a resolution for all that. But this time, I think we'd sort of said, okay, look, we'll do the same thing, kind of, but this time we'll do it properly. This time we're going to go back to the collection, tie all that off, do something, and then put Bernice somewhere new and, you know, do the year zero thing. So it's an interesting experience in that, in terms of just... dealing with the expectations of an audience, really, and listening to them, and not shortchanging them, really. It was an education just in gave me a lot of respect for people who managed to make a story arc work through, you know, a massive TV series, because getting the simplest story arc to work between four scripts by different writers, all of whom I knew. Often turn out to be like, God, this is a lot harder than I was expecting.
Can I just throw your mind back to, because you're a fan of Benny before Big Finish took it on, right?
Yeah.
So when Lisa Bauman was cast and you heard those audios for the first time, how close was she to the Benny in your head?
I felt that she was, I don't know, it's always going to be different. She was a bit different. I always do, in fact, in some ways, and it's, it, you know, you've got to let someone have their interpretation of the character, is I almost do sort of think of them as being slightly different characters in the way that, I don't know, in the way that different incarnations of Batman are slightly different characters, you know what I mean? That you kind of think, yeah, they're the same, but also, like, that's their take on it, and that's another one. And, yeah, I feel like, so, but it, because I knew Paul Cornell had based her on physically and body language wise on Emma Thompson. And that's how I'd always kind of pictured her. And it's like, well, you know, you've got to, it would be ridiculous to say to Lisa, do an impression of Emma Thompson for, you know, to play this character. So she's come up with her own kind of way of playing her, which feels sort of like just as familiar now and just its own, yeah, its own thing. But yeah, it is, it wasn't quite the same, but I didn't expect it to be, you know, it's always going to be a bit different.
You've written for River Song as well. Are they the same character?
No. I always find River definitely has a different feel to her. There's something, and I can definitely see the roots of like the creators in both of them. Like Benny is the kind of character that Paul Connell creates, and River is the kind of character Stephen Moffat creates, and they're different. They're different types of writer, and they create different types of character.
So how would you see the differences between the two characters then?
How do I see the difference between them? I don't know. River, there is something fundamentally, I don't know, there's a flippancy to River. But they both do have a certain flippancy to them. But I do feel like River, I think there's always, actually, you know what? I think there's always something slightly, not all Stephen's characters, but there's a core of something a little bit insane to a lot of his characters, which always seems to come out. And I think that like people who just aren't there's always people who just aren't quite right. They're always a bit kind of they jar a bit with reality slightly. And I think River is one of those. I don't think Benny does jar with reality. I think actually she, one of the things I really loved about her in the New Adventures was that she did feel three-dimensional and grounded, and you know, and it was just fascinating having, you know, a companion who meets the Doctor, you know, when she's just turned 30, and she's sort of, so it's almost a period of the Doctor is almost sort of a bit of a midlife crisis in a way. So whereas River, I think, doesn't really think about her life that way at all. I think that is it. Like you always I think it's that thing of like, yeah, jarring slightly with reality, I think.
You've written some Blake Seven as well. Have you got a background in terms of liking Blake Seven?
Yeah, definitely. That was another thing. It was a couple of friends when I got into Doctor Who, and I was at secondary school. I had a couple of friends who liked Blake Seven. One who was a big fan, actually both of them, their parents had both liked it and bought the videos. In fact, I had a friend who his dad was a sci-fi fan of such long standing that he actually had Blake Seven. He had the bought videotapes up to season 3, and then he stopped buying them because he had his original off airs from 1981. And he was like the kind of guy he was so into a sci-fi that he would record routinely the first episode of anything. That looked any sci-fi show that came on, he would record the first one and watch it, just in case he liked it and wanted to record the whole thing. So he had a lot of things from episode one. And that was how I got to Blake Seven, was borrowing the tapes from them, and I was interested in a lot of older TV shows at the time, and so that was something which I just watched it all the way through and really liked it, and it was always something that I was eager to write for if I got the chance.
So with the large variety of stories that you've done, have you generally been given an idea commission to do it, or do you approach Big Finish and say, this is a story I'd like to write? How does it usually work?
It varies. Like I said, sometimes it has been quite specific. Like I think probably the most specific was Situation Vacant, as you mentioned before, was like, you know, we have a specific thing that we want to do, and, you know, weave this into the story for us. More normally, I don't normally come to them with, I mean, actually Fanfare for the Common Man was one where I did just come to them completely cold and say I'd like to do a Beatles story. But more normally, at the very least, I will approach them and say, what sort of gap do you have? Are there any areas where you've got, like, you could, you know, any ranges basically where you've got some gaps that you're looking for a pitch for? So I at least want to know which Doctor I'm going for at first. And often they'll give me like a vague steer, like, which will just be in terms of like not coinciding with other things that they've already done. So like Alan once said, can you come up with a contemporary story for the Seventh Doctor that uses a setting that we haven't really seen in Doctor Who before? And he said, like, I know that's a big ask, but can you think of something? And after I went away and I was like, what about a shipyard? I went, yes, we've never had a Doctor Who story in a shipyard. Okay, let's do that. So sometimes it will be very loose. But the one I did this year that's just come out this month, Intelligence for War, that was Nick Briggs saying, we need a third Doctor story. It'd be Third Doctor and Liz, 7 parts. And the only thing he gave me was, he said, we'd like it to be quite Liz-centric. And I think he had the idea of something where Liz comes under suspicion for something, like, you know, she ends up being interrogated, she's been suspicion of being a traitor or something along those lines. And I really like getting things like that because it's quite a small thing and it's not the whole story, but it does give you something to work with. And really the whole story just unfolded from there. And just, yeah, just from that little kernel, the whole thing came about. So I quite like working that way. But also it can be quite a nice challenge sometimes to just to be given those quite specific briefs or those shopping lists of things that they want you to do and then trying to make something out of them. I do enjoy doing that as well.
So with that, your latest story that's just been out, I've only listened to the first couple of episodes. I tried to get through it all. It didn't quite make it. How much did you have to go back and listen to go back to the seventh season? I mean, one of the things I love about it is it's got that sting in it that it does the recap and then the music sting comes in, which is very Ambassadors of Death. Was that something you wrote into the script, the sting to go in?
It was established. I think Nick actually already did that in previous stories. He did. It's definitely. I'm sure I remember. Yeah, it's definitely in the Annihilators. It's something he was quite keen to do to really give that sense of the season 7 thing. So I knew they were gonna do that. I mean, in terms of going back to them, I didn't go back to them at all because I know them so well, those ones. particularly Inferno, because that was a real favourite. I've seen that so many times. And I also had one that you couldn't get here at the time, The Ambassadors of Death. I had a pen pal from in New Zealand who I used to swap tapes with. I'd get him the new series of Red Dwarf before it came on TV over there, and he'd say, like, well, what Doctor Who do you want? And I specifically got Ambassadors because, and The Mind of Evil, because I thought they were unlikely to be on VHS anytime soon here. And so I had a tape of Ambassadors that I've seen so many times. And actually, that was the one that I really wanted to kind of summon up the spirit of, really, was Ambassadors of Death and those sort of like different factions working against each other. And the fact that it sort of ends up in quite a different place to where it started out. I had to write it kind of quite quickly. So I kind of felt like I actually quite like the fact that it gave it a kind of written week to week sense, because that's kind of how Ambassadors of Death feels. That was actually what I wanted out of it.
From Big Finish Productions, Doctor Who, The Third Doctor Adventures, Intelligence for War.
Liz, listen to this. Lone Nazi invades Norfolk pub.
What are you reading, Doctor?
Did you make background checks on Dr. Shaw before you appointed her?
God me!
What was it? I didn't see.
Something that really shouldn't be here.
Fire! I'm talking about the Anti-War Alliance.
Is it true we're secretly at war with another planet?
Of course not.
We have a deeply alarming situation developing.
Brigadier, this is a very sensitive area in terms of global politics.
I suppose I want to equip people to better understand the world and not get trapped into ways of thinking that drag us all down.
To make the world a better place?
Yes.
Wait a minute. Where are you going?
Cambridge.
I learned a lot, but also not enough. And I don't know what to do next.
I'll help you, but you have to tell me everything.
So what do you use this bunker for, Brigadier?
I will not calm down. Tell me what's
going
on.
Walk out, restrain Dr. Shaw, please.
Don't touch me!
Something in the underground, they're saying. The army's been called in. Harold Chorley just interviewed one of them.
That isn't Liz Shaw.
This is fascinating.
Too fascinating.
Brian, I find the way you see the world fascinating.
You're the doctor?
Yes. How do you do?
Yeah, you're not what I imagined at all.
Big Finish, for the love of stories.
Now, names of stories are really important to me. Whenever I write a story, I usually come up with a name first. One story that you wrote really stood out to me, and that was in the Eighth Doctor and Charlotte Pollard box set, which is almost 2 years old now. Can you believe it's nearly been 2 years since that was released? The Slaying of the Writhing Mass. That really jumped out at me, and I love the quirkiness of that story. But this was the first time you'd written for the Eighth Doctor and Charlie on their own. First of all, how important to you is the name of a story?
I tend to find with them that I don't like coming up with titles. I find it quite frustrating. Usually they come very quickly and always feel right, or they take ages and they never quite feel right. It is important because, I don't know, I think it's increasingly important these days because, you know, you've got to, you really want to conjure up images in someone's head. It's like, the title is a small bit of real estate that you've got to kind of sell your story on. And so it's quite frustrating when you can't come up with something that really sums it up. I quite like the fact that there's been a trend, certainly in novels, towards long titles, because you can get quite a lot of information into a long title. I always think maybe it's not so bad now, but there was definitely a trend a few years ago when every bloody TV show seemed to have a one-word title. And I was thinking, God, that's a lot. It's a lot to try and like get across what makes your show distinctive and different in one word. I remember watching like a continuity announcement at the end of one show, and the announcer had mixed up the titles of the two shows he was meant to be announcing. Because like they just either title could fit on either show. I didn't blame him for mixing them up. But actually, funny enough, it's funny you should mention The Slaying of the Writhing Mass, because it was originally called Ringside Seats and The Slaying of the Writhing Mass. And that's too long. That's too much. I thought, okay, right. I was like, I actually quite like the fact that it was so excessive. That was what, I think also because I'd written so many stories for Big Finish at that point, I'd run out of all my, I don't know, have I ever done one that's called, I think I must have done some that are called like The Thing of Thing, that traditional Doctor Who story title format. But that's the thing. I've written so many and there have been so many, but I'm not afraid of like making them quite distinctive. Like it took ages to come up with an acceptable title for Intelligence for War, because it's like we want to have, it was called Army of Traitors for a while, which I quite liked. But it was like, we want something that sort of feels Pertwee-ish, but also, you know, contains everything that we want to say about it. You know, it was difficult. What was your other question about that? Eighth Doctor and Charlie. Yeah, I'd actually not thought of the fact that I'd not written for them on their own. Yeah, no, it's weird because I feel like I've written for Charlie quite a bit. But of course, I've done one with her and Keres, and then I did another one I did two with her and Colin. Maybe I hadn't really thought about having done. But they're a good combination. It's one of the good things I would say about Charlie is that with some of them, you do sort of think like, well, this is just an ordinary person. Would they really kind of run into danger like that? And with Charlie, you don't worry about that because she will run into danger. She's sort of a good one to kind of initiate action, because she'll go and find things out. She'll go and look for things. So yeah, you don't have to think like, oh, why is Charlie doing this? No, she just does stuff. She's like the Doctor in that respect. She will just go and she'll go and talk to people. She'll go and investigate the mystery.
There's a couple of stories actually that we've actually looked at in detail, I've realised. We did a whole episode on Time in Office, looking at that episode, because just, it's so amusing how you've done that in terms of the four distinct stories. And then once again, were you asked to do four stories and then link them together, or you just went off and... Once again, the comedy in that is hilarious.
Yeah, I think I was asked, and actually, because what I do remember about this one is that it was originally going to be a subscriber special, so it was just going to be one episode. And for some reason, I can't remember, there was some, it went quiet, and then it was like, and then Alan came back to me and said, we ended up doing something else as the Scriber Special for reasons, but I still promised you this one, and I would like you to do it. And it was, and it, that was that. I'd been given the brief for that as well. I'd been given the brief of the Doctor comes back, has to do some President stuff after the Five Doctors, and Leela is there. But yeah, it was just going to be one story at that point. And I cannot remember whether it was me or Alan who suggested structuring it. I think it was Alan who suggested structuring it as four one-part stories. But that was, yeah, I mean, that just immediately made me, when I started thinking about it that way, I started thinking of it as if I was writing a four episode sitcom for Radio 4 about the Doctor being president. And obviously it summons up, you know, political comedies like The Thick of It and Yes Minister and things like that. And yeah, that was one that just immediately seemed to tend towards humour for some reason. I don't know. I like giving Peter Davison funny stuff to do because I think it gets forgotten, particularly by Doctor Who fans, it gets forgotten how good a comic actor he is because he was coming after Tom and in an era when they were trying to tone down the comedy a bit. You know, it's easy to forget that, like, at the time he was, you know, at the time he was in Doctor Who, most of the other things he was doing. Exactly, yeah. He was basically, at that moment, he was Doctor Who and a sitcom star. That was kind of what he was. And I guess, like, again, you know, Doctor Who offered a contrast in that sense. But I had him in my Radio 4 sitcom, Welcome to Our Village, Please, and Very Carefully. And he's just, yeah, he's such a great comic actor that I just like giving him that stuff. The end up being, I can't remember why, it ended up being put back a bit after, I know it came out quite a while after I'd written it. And I remember going back and Alan said, do you want to give it another pass just to see if there's anything that you're not happy with, you know, since you have the opportunity? And I went, yeah, I will do. And I got the scripts out. And post Donald Trump, the idea of the Doctor becoming president and deciding to be a disruptive force actually seemed a bit less amusing than I'd thought at the time. I kind of thought, oh, actually, people who like get into politics to be disruptive are awful. And so I toned some of that stuff down a bit and made it a bit less deliberate, a bit less, made him a bit less of a kind of crashing in and going like, oh, I'm just going to do stuff that everyone says you can't do because I can do it because I, you know, I'm the president and you have to do what I say. So yeah, I was a bit more careful about that. And I was glad that I had the chance to do those tweaks and to rein that in a bit.
Now, you mentioned Subscriber Specials before. You did one of my favorites, which is The Five Companions.
Mm.
I'm trying to think, it was Stephen, I'm trying to think who they all were.
It's Stephen, Ian, Sarah, Kingdom, and Polly. It was going to be Vicky, but it was, yeah, it was going to be Vicky because it was going to be like the four main Hartnell era companions that they were working with at the time. I don't think they were, yeah, maybe. I don't know, was the talk of Susan? Anyway, it was going to be more Hartnell focused. And then Maureen O'Brien couldn't do it. And so we got Annika Wills instead because it's like, well, that's okay. You know, like we associate her more with Shroud, but she is a Hartnell companion as well. But that was one where I pitched them a quite weird and complicated idea based on. I don't think it was going to be, was it going to be tied to the Five Doctors? Must have been. But I do remember that the idea I came up with was quite, they'd all been kind of snatched away shortly before, all these characters had been snatched away shortly before their deaths. And they'd ended up basically back in the Mechanoid prison. The Mechanoids had built a new, more sophisticated prison for them. They hadn't built it for them. The Mechanoids had built a more sophisticated prison, and something was trapped in it, and it had tried to find the people who'd escaped from it before, and that was why they had Ian and Stephen there, and Vicky. Yeah, that was what it was going to be. Yeah, so they were trying to find the ones who'd who'd escaped from it before, but they'd escaped from a less sophisticated version of it. And no one liked it.
Yes.
No, I really liked that idea and no one else did. So they said, can you not just do something that's a bit more, like, can you just do something where, like, there's another death zone and there's Daleks there, and then they just escape, and I was like, all right, yeah, I'll just do that. And everyone liked that. But I always kept that. I think they were right. The idea that I'd come up with was not very suitable. But in the end, that was actually, I turned that into my second novel, Hearts of Oak. I'd always kind of held on to that idea. And yeah, and you can actually think, if you read it, there's four characters who are stuck in this alien prison in that. And they're called Iona, Victor, something else. I can't remember what the other one's called. And one of them is called Steve, but you don't find that out until the end. And yeah, literally, I took my original pitch and I changed all their names into someone slightly different, and made up new characters based around them. So yeah, that the original version for the Five Companions actually did. Oh, and there's the character who breaks into it from the outside who's called Alyssa, and that was Nyssa. So yeah, I completely changed everyone. So, you know, really filed off the serial numbers so that there's nothing copyrightable underneath. But it's just, yeah, my original idea. It's one time I've occasionally had things with Big Finish pitches that didn't go anywhere. And you just sort of go, oh yeah, you know, well, that's just, sometimes they don't work out. But that was one where it just stuck in my mind and I thought, I really want to do that in some form. And so I ended up turning it into a novel. So.
We were talking about structure a little bit earlier, and a story that has just flashed up in front of me is Power Game. Was that yours?
Yeah.
It was alongside Black Thursday, which was a two-parter. So there was a period where they were so often doing lots of two-part stories in the monthly range. And even ID, which was an early one of yours, that had a three-part story and a one-part story on there called Urgent Calls. Was that yours too, Urgent Calls?
Yeah.
So we actually had a guest on who said Urgent Calls was her favourite Doctor Who audio story ever.
Great!
So that was pretty cool. What about structure? What kind of format is perfect for you as a Doctor Who story? Do you like to play around with the different lengths, or is there a perfect length in your mind?
I don't think there is a perfect length, because I think what's interesting. It's interesting you bring this up, because every time I get asked to do something of a different length, it always changes things slightly. I mean, one thing I found really odd with ID that I hadn't expected to happen was that having written for Cast of Eight, I suddenly found that actually with only three episodes, it was less imperative to have lots of characters. I think it also helped that I had the Doctor on his own in that one, I think. So I kind of had other characters to play around with who could kind of slot into the companion role for a bit. But I did find that I ended up with a character left over, and actually I'd kind of anticipated that the Scandroids and that would have to be played by somebody else doubling up. But we ended up having enough free that we could get another actor to do that and to develop his own performance for it and to do a different voice, and I think that was really useful. I quite like three parts, actually. Four parts can sometimes feel like you need a bit more material to kind of fill it out. So I know a lot of Doctor Who fans kind of feel like four parts is it, but I quite like three. I mean, Urgent Calls, because that's a two-hander, and that's something that would be, I know people have done two-handers for longer, like, because Scherzo, Rob Sherman's one was a two-hander, wasn't it? But it was, I definitely found that, like, you know, when I was told it's only going to be one part, I did think, like, oh, we could do it and it would just be a two-hander and it'd be easier to sustain that in that format. But the two-part, it just affects how you do tell the story in the first place. I probably could have come up with a version of Power Game that would have been four parts, but I probably would have needed more locations and more incident going on, and maybe, you know, another layer to it. But I don't know. I think that, you know, the idea that it was, I think, because it was essentially just, I mean, that was completely inspired by the fact that, I don't know if you know, that the British series, The Adventure Game, which I used to watch as a kid, and used to have it's sort of the special effects based sci-fi game show that had celebrities on it. Janet Fielding was one of the contestants once, and it was really just I just had the idea of like, what if, you know, that was the base of a Doctor Who story? What if people were being made to play the adventure game for real, but they see it, it, but it's somehow breaking into our world as a TV series. Yeah, that, and I don't know, maybe that idea would have been a bit difficult to sustain over four episodes, but for two, I think it filled it nicely.
And I guess you could be writing a two-parter, and then you could be writing a story of the same length without the need for cliffhangers. So I guess that could change the flow of the story too.
It does change the flow of the story, yeah. And it can be, it's an interesting stretch to work with doing the cliffhangers, but it can sometimes be a bit of a pain when you feel, oh, actually, you know, that beat of the story would be better if it was 10 minutes earlier, but you need the cliffhanger. It does give you something to hang things on. But it is nice. I always like it if, you know, it's nice if cliffhangers are based on some kind of opening out of the plot rather than just a random moment of peril that is then immediately resolved, you know. So it's, if you can kind of make the story work that way, then that's good. Yeah.
You also have the privilege of being really the last person to write for William Russell in terms of a major role with Susan's War, so Carol Ann Ford. Mm. And then bizarrely took them back to the Sensphere with the censor rights. What was the decision to do a sequel to the censor rights?
Oh, well, that was one where they asked me to do it. And I think the funny thing was, I think they didn't know at the time what a big fan of the censor rights I am. Because it only kind of, like, it's one of the things where I didn't see it coming. I wrote All Hands on Deck, my short trip for Susan, thinking, well, this is chronologically the last Susan story. I was thinking, oh, she goes off to war and that's it. I wasn't thinking we would get to tell that story. And then everyone who heard it went like, oh, you're setting up a spin-off there, aren't you? And I was like, no. But then Big Finish went, yes, actually, yes, let's have a seat, let's have a spin-off. And I think just really, they felt that I didn't really have any hand in creating that series, but they went like, you know, because you wrote All Hands on Deck, we feel like, you know, you should write the first one. But it was their idea to kind of go, you know, their first thing was they were thinking like, okay, what would Susan be doing in this instance? And they were thinking, okay, so what if she is going out, like trying to do diplomacy, bringing other alien races into the war? And actually, from that point of view, if you were looking at ones from the stories that she'd been in, the Censorites really are the obvious ones. They're the only kind of, yeah, because they're the only aliens that are actually in any way friendly, really, that she, is that right? I've said that, I don't know if it's right. Yeah, it's them and the Thals are already, you know, are kind of already accounted for. And so, yeah, that was the idea came up, that would you like to do Susan, goes and gets Ian, and they go to the Sensphere, and they have to try and negotiate for the Sensorites to join in the war. And I was like, that's one of all the things you could offer me to write, that's one of the things I would most like to write. And yeah, that was great. I love doing that. And it made sense to have Ian there, because, you know, he'd visited them before, and so we set up this whole idea that, you know, that he was someone they would trust. And also it went back to all those, it was interesting because I had to go back to the debates that they had over, you know, whether to fight the Daleks or not, when they were trying to convince the Thals to fight the Daleks. And it's an interesting one because that's in that argument, that's the one where Susan and Ian are on the same side. They're the ones who are saying, you know, we can't just ask these people to fight our battle for us. So that'll work. And the only thing that was a bit of a stumbling block in that was that it was unclear whether at first, I didn't think we'd be able to, we wouldn't be able to have the Daleks in it. We could talk about the Daleks, but they couldn't be in it. And when I wrote the script, there was a bit of the reaction was a bit like, oh, well, it feels a bit like, I don't know, there's not really, the threat feels a bit sort of, I don't know exactly what they were saying. It was something to the effect of, well, I don't know, it feels a bit static, but the threat isn't really there. And I'm like, yes, because the threat isn't really there. It's not because the Daleks aren't in it. I was having them talk, and they felt like it was like, oh, it's missing something. I was like, yeah, it's literally missing the actual villain of the piece and not in it. But it turned out that because of the way the box set was going.
Is it because of cost you can't have them? Are the expenses?
Yeah, it was literally that. It was how much it was the cost of licensing Daleks for them, and it was but what they realized that was because it was coming out as a box set and they were gonna have the Daleks in the last one, the license actually covered the Daleks to be in Mine at no extra expense. As I understand it, I think it was no extra expense. So suddenly they came back and they're like, okay, you can have some Daleks. I was like, great, because it turned out that the Daleks have been manipulating things all along, but they weren't in it. And it was just, it worked much better with them just being in it a bit of this sort of shadowy presence. That was perfect. So I was glad that worked out, because it would have been disappointing if that one had been compromised, because it was such a special one for me to do.
We, of course, know you through Big Finish and your Doctor Who work, but you've done lots of other stuff as well. What are some of the other areas of your writing that you're most proud of?
Yeah, well, there's my novels, and say, like, as well as Hearts of Oak, I've done another sci-fi novel called Tomorrow Never Knows, and another one that came out last year called Drunk and All Your Strange New Words. I'm proud of having done those. At one point, I didn't think I'd really be able to cut it as a prose writer, and that I'd be better off in scripts, but prose has sort of opened up to me in recent years. That's I'm really proud of those books. But I like being, you know, I think part of the reason why I'm drawn to Doctor Who is I like things in different genres. I like lots of different things. And yeah, one of the, a lot of my comedy work I'm proud of having done, like as well as Welcome to Our Village, Please Invade Carefully, which is sort of a sci-fi sitcom. I did a rom-com a couple of years ago for Audible, which was called Car Crash, which the producer I was working with, I was pitching him something else entirely, a thriller. And he said, oh, that didn't fly, but Audible are looking for a rom-com apparently. I don't know if that's any interest to you. And I was like, yes, I'd love to do that. So I did that. And we ended up... It was recorded during a lockdown or under COVID restrictions. So I couldn't go to the studio because it was unnecessary for me to be there. But I said, oh, can we have an audio feed so I can just listen in? And at the end, I thanked the actors. But our male lead for that was Alfie Enoch, William Russell's son. And I was like, I can't. Oh, if I was actually in the studio with him, I would open up. I'd tell him, look, I've actually written for your dad in recent years. I'm like, yeah, I've got an action figure of him on my shelf as I'm looking at it. And I was like, I guess this is too weird a conversation to get into just over an audio feed. If it was normal conditions, I would just say, oh, do you want to just, we can just go for a drink and I can just say, you know, how much I admired his dad and how much it meant for me to work, to write for him. But no, I didn't feel I could do that. But yeah, no, I was very pleased with that one. I love animation and having a career in writing animation has been very special to me as well.
Now, Peter Davison mentioned Welcome to Our Village, Please Invade Carefully on the extras for Fanfare for the Common Men. He said, oh, this is a really good script from Eddie. What was his involvement with that?
With Welcome to Our Village?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So no, it was, we cast him as, he's one of the regulars. So he, So the concept is that this one alien, this one little village in Buckinghamshire has been invaded by aliens for kind of pilot scheme for a bigger invasion. And the main character is this woman who'd gone home to visit her parents for the weekend. And then like the village gets stuck behind a force field and the outside world forgets it exists because it's been invaded by aliens. And so we were looking for who would play. Yeah, when we were casting it, we were sort of thinking, well, who could play her parents? And Peter was one of the first names I thought of for it, and he said yes. And it was one of the things where I just sort of think, like, you know, it was really weird to just sort of go like, can we get Peter Davison to be in this? And and my producer went, I'll check. Yes, we can. And I was like, oh right. if only I'd known it was that easy. It was wonderful to work with him, and I kind of, you always sort of think, like, you know, there's probably stuff that gives away. I mean, I think probably the entire concept gives away that I was a Doctor Who fan, and there's probably little references in it that would probably give the game away as well. Depends how into it you were. There's one bit, in one episode someone, a fire alarm goes off and someone has to walk out of a building while she's taking an exam. And she stops to get her lucky mascot on her table, which is a little stuffed panda. And like people said, was that a reference to The Chase? And I was like, yeah, obviously it was a reference to The Chase. It's like Stephen going back to get Hi-Fi and nearly dying. But one day we were just sort of doing a read-through with the cast. And I had my pen out that I was just writing all the scripts with. And we just took a break briefly. And then I went to get a snack. And when I came back to the table, Peter had picked up my pen. And I hadn't even thought about what it was. It was just the pen that I was usually using. But it was like one that had a little TARDIS in it that went up and down. And, you know, it was like suspended in water. And when you turned it upside down, the TARDIS went up. And then you turned. And he was just sort of like turning it up and like making it go up and down and just sort of looking at me going, yeah. Like, yes. Yes.
What are you working on at the moment you can tell us about?
Oh, God. What am I working on at the moment that I can actually tell you about? I don't know if there's anything I can tell you about. I've spent a lot that I've been doing a lot of writing. I've been doing a lot of writing books for about computer games in the last year, which is sort of not particularly secret, but also not. I've been doing some work on an animated show that may or may not happen, so I can't really say anything about that. But writing another novel that may or may not happen. For the first time in ages, I've not really got anything coming up that is definitely imminent, apart from, say, these various computer games books that I've been writing. But I've got things that will hopefully happen. I had a couple of things that came out. I had a game that I'd made, like an interactive story called Nocturne Hotel, that's on an app called Richcast. I've never made a game before, but that's come out now. And I had the Big Finish Play, that's also come out now. So, yeah, first time in ages that I don't actually have anything imminently coming up. I've just put out a book of my... I did a bunch of columns for Doctor Who Figurine Collection called The Big Ask, where you talk about continuity questions and plot holes and things like that. And that was fun to do. And then after the magazine folded, I kind of realised, you know, a lot of this stuff... some of the columns hadn't come out at all because I delivered them before the thing had folded. And a lot of them had not been very well distributed. And also just because, you know, if you only got to read it if you bought the figurine, you know, you were buying these like sort of big figurines of Doctor Who characters. So if you weren't buying those, then you wouldn't read the magazine. So I just thought, oh, I'll put them out as an ebook. And I've been meaning to do that for ages. And finally, I was laid up with COVID last week and I thought, oh, I'll do it. I'll just finish compiling them together and stick it on the Kindle store and the Kobo store I've done so far. And that's had a nice response so far. That's called Do Time Lords Get Drunk and Other Important Questions About Doctor Who. So I'm quite pleased with that, but yeah.
Fantastic. Listen, Eddie, we are really appreciative of all the stuff that you've already produced and we're looking forward to hopefully getting more in the future. And so thank you so much for your time tonight.
Yeah, thank you.
Coming soon from Big Finish Productions, Doctor Who, The Companion Chronicles, The Jigsaw War.
They're going to be through that door in a few minutes. Come on, man, think!
Jamie McCrimmon.
Who are you?
My name's Moran, Ord's Chief Moran.
Ah, well, nice to meet you.
Where's the Doctor? Hurry, they'll be through that door any second. I think we need to talk to the Doctor. Perhaps he's misinterpreted what's happening.
Aye. Misinterpreted all that muddering.
What are you waiting for? Do it before they cut through!
But I don't know what it's going to do to them.
I've told you everything I know.
I'm even wearing your uniform.
Please, I don't know.
This is a canny wee trick, but I'm onto you. You're just trying to confuse me, make me something...
Why are you doing this? Why are you trying to make me think the rest was all a dream?
Me?
But it can't be worse than what they're going to do to us. I'll do it!
No, you won't!
Jamie is currently experiencing a series of encounters with the stout young officer I'm speaking through now. But Jamie's experiencing them out of chronological sequence. If he puts them in order, he'll have a code. The code will unlock the door.
No, wait! This could be important. This couldn't kill a fuck. And what if Jamie fails?
Oh, ye of little faith.
What if he fails?
He will join me.
What if he doesn't want to?
What he'll want to do won't come into it.
Subscribers get more at bigfinish.com.
All right, so that was great having a chat with Eddie Robson for the first time, and hopefully it won't be the last time. He's done some great stuff over the years, and it was lovely to chat with him, as always, Philip.
Yeah, it was great. He had so much knowledge and brought some lovely things to life. So it was a wonderful time. Thank you, Eddie.
Excellent. Before we finish up today, just a couple of recommendations or things that we've been listening to. And what I'd like to recommend is, my list says it's your turn, Philip. You've got to go first. Oh,
it's my turn. Okay, well, I'll go first then. This podcast has actually been around for a while. It's called The Untitled Star Trek Project. It's Nathan Bottomley, who you might know from Flight to Eternity?
Flight Through Entirety.
And other things as well. And I don't think you, the guy who does the hamster with a pen nose. No, hamster, blunt hamster. No.
Oh, Joe Ford.
Joe Ford. So Joe Ford and my brain's not working. I'm glad you just put up with me. Never mind. So Joe Ford and Nathan Bottomley, every week they randomly choose a Star Trek story from any series. And so they're going from original, Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, what are the rest of them? Picard.
Discovery.
The one I really love at
the moment.
Strange New Worlds. And then they've got the cartoons as well, the original series cartoon. They've got the Janeway one, which I can't even think what that's called at all.
Lower Decks
is hilarious. And so they just randomly pick something from one of those. And often they say, oh, we'll just 90s Star Trek. And they just go from 90s Star Trek or something newer. And they discuss it beforehand. And that to me is the bit I really love. They're just the sort of 5-10 minutes discussion of the story beforehand. And then they play it and they talk over, hear it being played, but they commentate to it. So you could actually watch at the same time as them. I know these stories backwards, though. I don't need to watch them while they're talking about them, because as I said, I grew up on Star Trek. I loved Next Generation. Deep Space Nine is by far the best series. Well, maybe you might want to disagree with me. That's
Deep Space Nine and the original, I think, are my two favorites.
Yeah, Deep Space Nine is just brilliant. Just where it went and just the storytelling and the arcs, just and the characterization, everything. Anyhow, I love it. And certainly. There were some really shocking ones in there, and there's some great ones in there. And I don't always agree with what they have to say, but it's always entertaining. And Joe is crazy. That amuses me no end. I think I mentioned it because he started a Buffy one up as well. Joe's just good fun to listen to and has some interesting insights. As I said, don't always agree with what they have to say, but it's always interesting how they say it. And so I've been really enjoying that. It's been making me go back and watch some Star Trek. So I often will try and watch the episode they're going to talk about before they do it. And if not, often they give me insights. I go watch it again and go, all this stuff I'd missed. And they really managed to bring out a lot of depth and thinking about a lot of them. So The Untitled Star Trek Project, worth listening to. What have you been listening to on travels, Dwayne?
Well, first of all, I'd like to just acknowledge a couple of podcasts who have been giving us lots of support. Particularly the Doctor Who Show. The boys from Doctor Who Show have been giving us lots of support on our events, and the guys from 42 to Doomsday as well. So if you're looking for some other Australian Doctor Who themed podcasts, go for the Doctor Who Show and 42 to Doomsday.
Yeah.
Really good stuff. Now, what I'd like to recommend is a recent Big Finish release. It's the new First Doctor adventure entitled Fugitive of the Daleks. It is a story that I think could possibly be one of my very favorites of the year. I'm a huge fan of The Chase, and so I'm a huge fan of Johnny Morris's writing as well. So when you combine Johnny's, you've got elements of The Chase. So it's done in a similar way with some extra special twists as well. Lauren Cornelius is always good as Dodo. Stephen Noonan, great as the First Doctor. And Maureen O'Brien, it's great to hear her voice, as always, but this time playing an older Vicky, which is a really interesting thing to do with this range. So that would be my recommendation. Wholeheartedly get behind Fugitive of the Daleks with Stephen Noonan as the Doctor.
Yeah, I mean, we've certainly been loving the First Doctor, and I think it was 2 years ago when we did our Big Finish review for 2022. I know one of the top ones we've had was the recast of the First Doctor and the stories he'd done. Last year's box set was fine, but you know, out of all the stuff that picked out, there's lots of really good stuff that we picked up elsewhere. But listening to the Fiji Dalek at the start of this year, I was just thinking, oh, wow, this has really hit the ground running. And there's bits that you just laugh through. It's more Dalek Master Plan than The Chase, I think, for me, which also had that whole element of, you know, changing locations all the time. But they really have, they've handled Vicky really well. Stephen Noonan plays the Doctor and has some more interesting things to do as well as part of the box set. I think they've really used him well. And the sound design and the music, it's just, yeah, it's certainly been the highlight of January releases. If Big Finish can keep hitting the mark each month with something like that, just at one, we're going to have lots of trouble when we do our Big Finish review for 2024, that's for sure.
That is absolutely, that's what I was thinking. It's only January and this has come out already. Well, it's February now, but it was a January release.
Well, two spectacular releases for January. Vision of the Daleks and the Centaurans, those two were off the charts good. So, and there's other good stuff too, absolutely. But those two, wow.
All right. That will do us for this installment of audio. Great to talk to you as always, Philip. And I'm looking forward to getting back together with you sooner rather than later to catch up with all the happenings at Wendy Padbury's events coming up in the next week. And
ditto, Dwayne. It's going to be fun.
All right, until next time, we'll catch you all later.
Bye, everyone.
This has been the Sirens of Audio episode 187, Memory Lane, with our guest Eddie Robson and your host Philip Edney and Dwayne Bunny. Theme music by Joe Kramer. More about us and tickets to Wendy Padbury in Sydney and Melbourne in February 2024 from sirensofaudio.com. Comment below to give us your feedback, or contact us via email at sirensofaudio@gmail.com or via any one of our socials using the handle @audiosirens. Thanks for listening, audiophiles. We'll hear you next time.